From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The head of Customs and Border Protection says the situation at the southern border has reached a breaking point. More migrant families have been crossing the U.S. and Mexico border seeking legal asylum, and now hundreds of agents are being temporarily reassigned to the El Paso sector to help address that flow. Julian Aguilar is an immigration and border security reporter for the Texas Tribune. He's in El Paso. Julian, give us the numbers that the government is giving.
Well, the government is saying that currently that Customs and Border Protection has more than 13,000 people in custody. This was when the commissioner spoke yesterday here in El Paso. And, you know, just to put that in perspective, he said a crisis level is 6,000. So 13,000 is, to use his word, unprecedented. In El Paso alone, as of 6 a.m. yesterday, Wednesday, they had 3,500 people in custody. And the situation is getting to a point where I think, you know, frustrations could boil over. Something, you know, a lot of folks that you talk to say something has to be done. The mayor of El Paso, who's a moderate Republican, you get the Shelter Network folks who are, you know, very open on immigration, and the, you know, diehard Republican folks. Everybody agrees that the situation could get unsustainable, at least here in El Paso.
Well, and let's be clear, Julian, these are mostly people legally seeking asylum. You have the legal right to seek asylum and come into this country. But the places where normally they are kept while their asylum claims are being considered are overflowing. So do we understand that they're, many of them being given a slip of paper and told to come back?
Exactly. That's what Border Patrol announced this week here in El Paso, that they're going to be given that slip of paper that you referenced, the NTA, the notice to appear, some with ankle monitors. You know, this is what the Trump administration decries as catch and release, but according to the commissioner, they have no choice. And to your point, you're absolutely right. Everybody has a right to seek asylum, and most people say, you know, do it at the ports of entry. But what we've seen the Trump administration do is place agents at the center of the bridges and turn people away because their processing centers are full. But be that as it may, just the sheer number, whether you're approaching the port or going in between the ports, the number is increasing, and it's a confluence of factors. The policies that the Trump administration had tried to implement are on hold with the courts. The smugglers know how to let folks know in Central America, like, this is your time to go. And the weather is also getting a lot better. It's not as cold as it was a few months ago in the high mountains in the desert of New Mexico and Texas. And springtime is, this is usually when you see an uptick because of the weather. It's not as treacherous yet as it will be in June and July and August.
Well, and this is a humanitarian crisis, you know, according to the officials there. But it also is a political crisis, because this is what people who are against a wall or funding for a wall have been saying. You actually need to divert funds to build more centers to hold these people when they are legally seeking asylum. But putting that aside, there's another aspect of this. We're just finding out that since February, the administration has changed its policy on the border there. People, single people without children caught crossing the border illegally, were supposed to be, under the Trump administration, you know, charged with a misdemeanor, maybe jailed for a time before being deported. But now these people, who it doesn't seem are seeking asylum, are just being deported without being charged?
That's one of the policy shifts, yes. And to put the numbers in perspective, you know, when we're talking about what's going on in fiscal year 2019, a lot of folks are saying, look at the numbers in the year 2000, 2001. They were so much higher. And what CBP said is that those used to be adult males from Mexico and who were immediately deportable. You know, what they used to call catch and release or voluntary returns. So the administration is still able to do that with folks from Mexico, but as we've seen since 2014, there's a provision in current federal law where if it's an unaccompanied minor, for example, from Central America, they are processed differently. But one thing is that folks aren't really talking about, unless you're an immigration attorney, is the backlog, the current backlog in immigration judges. I mean, the president has sort of downplayed the need for more immigration judges, and I think that's sort of one of the dark horse factors here that people aren't really considering while they're looking at the immediate problem on the ground. But sure, once these people get released, they're going to wait 2 to 3 years before they even get an initial hearing. And the backlog is already sky high, I think reaching record levels as it is in the immigration courts. And with respect to diverting more funds, El Paso, in the El Paso area at least, there is an effort now to build a processing center so you have more space where these folks are giving medical attention and their process there instead of having to camp out for 48, 72 hours under a bridge, under an international bridge.
Yeah, just released Wednesday. And as you said, more judges then to process them as they go through that center are also needed. Julian Aguilar, immigration and border security reporter for the Texas Tribune. He's there in El Paso. Julian, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, President Trump continued to hammer the media for its coverage of the Russia investigation last night. He spent most of an hour on TV with Fox News host Sean Hannity. Here's Hannity.
It is a disgrace that the media in this country has ignored what is the biggest single abuse of power corruption scandal in our lifetimes because of what they have as groupthink. Frankly, it has now evolved into a psychotic rage against a duly elected president.
Joining us now is NPR media correspondent and On Point co-host David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
And before we talk about this and the media's coverage of the Russia investigation leading up to the Barr letter about the Mueller report, let's listen to another Fox News host. This is Tucker Carlson on Monday night.
Politicians and prosecutors and intel agency heads told us implausible lies about Russian collusion. Reporters are paid to push back, but they didn't. Instead, they welcomed those lies and then amplified them. They're proud to do that.
David, do these critics of the media have a point, or what's your verdict on mainstream media coverage of the Mueller investigation leading up to the release of the Mueller report, at least to the attorney general?
Well, and first, let's give props to the president and Sean Hannity for doing effectively a live stream of the conversation they have every night anyway. I think that there is something to be said for some critique of the media in two ways, one of which is, you know, you're hearing no disaggregation there. But Tucker Carlson has a point when it comes to the more ideological cable talk shows. You think of folks on MSNBC making statements that stretched beyond what we knew and what we now know, particularly with the declarativeness and the seeming clarity of the idea that the president and his cohorts definitely must have committed crimes when it came to collusion with Russia or obstruction of justice. And I think you can think of some major stories that were wrong in BuzzFeed. The Washington Post had one story. CNN had a couple in which had to be retracted. But this was also in a deluge of other reporting that really propelled our understanding farther, particularly of the question of the president and his circle's relationship and business interests and interactions with Russian figures. And so I think it's unfair to say somehow there was some false notion planted here. This was, after all, among other things, a counterintelligence investigation started after an advisor to the president, George Papadopoulos, acknowledged something to a foreign diplomat from Australia that there was knowledge of emails that Russians had that would be damaging. So it was a real thing that was being covered.
And I guess the White House point of view at this point is that even if there weren't stories that were incorrect, that the media spent so much time talking about this, and if in fact Mueller, and again, all we know is what the Attorney General William Barr says is in the Mueller report, but if in fact Mueller says that the president did nothing wrong, then why was the media focusing on this for so long?
I think there were times where the framing really did suggest that we knew the outcome. The constant references to Watergate may have suggested we know how this story plays out with the question of impeachment proceedings. The president resigned. We don't know how this is going to play out. And I think at times people spoke with certainty beyond the reporting. I think that's a good reminder for reporters. But I think there's a lot of reporting that has been borne out. Whether or not it reaches the level of criminality is actually a different bar. Something can still be newsworthy and shocking. And the second thing is something to underscore what you just said. We don't know fully what's in the Mueller report. This may be a great moment for the president, or this may be, you know, a high that the president can ride to election day in 2020. But we don't really know what underlying is there and how damaging that will prove to be.
And now we're hearing that the report is actually hundreds of pages to up to 1,000 pages, less than 1,000 pages, according to the House Judiciary Committee chairman. There is also criticism from the left about the media's coverage. This is The Intercept's Glenn Greenwald speaking to Democracy Now! On Monday.
This is the saddest media spectacle I've ever seen since I began practicing journalism in 2005. And what makes it even sadder is to watch all of the people who vested their journalistic credibility into what proved to be a complete and total fraud and scam.
Now, we should point out that The New Yorker reports that Greenwald himself has been in touch personally with Julian Assange of WikiLeaks going back many years. But you've spoken to Greenwald. Where is he coming from in this criticism?
Well, you know, he's somebody who's long been a critic of, among other things, the national security state, the intelligence agencies, military agencies, and the way in which the press interacts with it and is often reflective and respective of it. And he sees also a sort of reflexive antagonism towards Russia. We talked at this for some length earlier this week about that, Glenn and I did. And he acknowledges that some of this is his pushback on what he sees as the kind of flagrant hypocrisy of the U.S. He says the U.S. and Russia back to Soviet days have been interfering with each other. So Mueller finds that the Russians interfered with our election. So what? And he kind of is pretty blasé about all of this, I think, in terms of what reporters have done. Reporters made some real mistakes here. That's different from saying they got the story totally wrong.
David, just if you could just give us a grade on the media coverage so far, what would it be?
You know, maybe a B, maybe a B plus. I think you'd have to separate it out. I think some individual journalists and some outlets, led by in many ways the Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, mm-hmm. and even places like BuzzFeed, which also gets some strong demerits for a story or two that they got too far out on mm-hmm. and couldn't get verified by others. You know, you've seen a lot of players do important journalism that really added to our understanding. I don't think there needs to be as much shamefacedness. I do think there has to be reckoning of keeping the rhetoric closer to the reporting.
NPR Media correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you.
You bet.
Steve Earle is a master storyteller, and he would tell you he learned from two of the best, Townes Van Zandt and Guy Clark. And in 1995, the three shared the stage at Nashville's Bluebird Cafe.
Me and No Bill, they both come from Georgia, met Hank out in New Mexico.
They're singing Steve Earle's Mercenary song. Well, a decade ago, Steve Earle won a Grammy for his album Townes, recordings of songs written by Van Zandt, who died in 1997. His new release is a bookend and a sad one. 16 songs written by Guy Clark, who died in 2016. It's simply called Guy, and it comes out tomorrow.
If I can just get out of this L.A. freeway when I can kill the cow.
Steve Earle's cover of Guy Clark's L.A. Freeway, and Steve Earle joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Steve, welcome back.
It's good to be back.
And what a beautiful tribute to your old friend, your mentor. But for the uninitiated, finish this sentence, and I have a feeling it's going to be more than a sentence. Guy Clark was...
The greatest story songwriter that ever lived. He was an incredibly disciplined artist and thought of himself as an artist. And we all did, everybody that came up, you know, his peers and the people that came up after him. You know, I got to Nashville at this moment when there was this salon going on with Guy and his wife, Susanna, at the center of it. And a lot of it was there was no place to play. We wrote new songs. We played them for each other sitting around rooms in the middle of the night. Mostly we were trying to impress Susanna, I think. she was... beautiful for one thing, but she also I learned how to write songs from Guy Clark and Townes Van Zandt, but mm-hmm. I learned how to carry myself as an artist from Susanna.
Well, first of all, there is a photograph that some say is one of the most famous in country music history. It was taken on Guy and Susanna's porch in 1972, and you can see the beautiful Susanna and Clark and Van Zandt and Daniel Antipolsky. It's a picture from photographer Al Clayton, so you can see a little of that world that you are describing. I mean, it's that sense of gathering of people and gathering of songs. And just talk about the songs. We just heard a little of L.A. Freeway. We're going to hear more in a second, but look at these lyrics. Pack up all your dishes, make note of all good wishes, say goodbye to the landlord for me. That son of a bee has always bored me. Throw out them L.A. papers and that moldy box of vanilla wafers. Adios to all this concrete. Go and get me some dirt road back street.
I'll be down the road in a cloud of smoke to some land. I am
It's just detail. That's what he did, you know, better than anybody that I'd ever seen up to that point. And for one of the reasons I threw everything I'd written up until I moved to Nashville away and started all over again when I got to Nashville and saw what other people were writing, and especially Guy. And I think something that I've discovered that I have is a great tool to be born with, maybe, is a memory for detail. Because Guy was writing stuff like Desperado's Waiting for a Train. That's about Jack Prigg, who died when Guy was
was grown, but most of that story comes from, you know, you're talking about an 8 or 9 or 10 year old Guy Clark.
Let's listen again to Desperados Waiting for a Train. Jack Prigg, who he thought was his grandfather, found out it was his grandmother's boyfriend.
Yeah.
Let's listen a little.
I'd play the Red River Valley. He'd sit in the kitchen and cry. Run his fingers to 70s living. One lot is every well I drill gone dry. We're friends. Me and this old man, like desperados waiting for a train.
So here he is singing about this guy, a drifter, a driller of oil wells. He taught me how to drive his car when he was too drunk to. He'd wink and give me money for the girls. From the time I could walk, he'd take me with him to a bar called the Green Frog Cafe. As you said, these childhood memories, he remembered.
He did. And the thing is, the difference between Guy Clark and Townes Van Zandt is like the difference between Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg. One, not particularly disciplined, didn't live very long, didn't work that much the last few years of his life. And then Allen and Guy were incredibly disciplined and left huge bodies of work. And so Guy had cancer the last 10 years of his life, and he still worked till the very end. And not like he was an angel. He had his own, you know, issues with various demons, but he got up and he worked every single day. And I learned from him that these things that artists do, they call them disciplines for a reason.
Yeah. Can you tell us more about, we hear about the grandfather. I want to listen to a little bit of Randall Knife, an elegy for his father. Let's listen.
My father was a good man, a lawyer by his trade. Only once did I ever see him misuse the blade. He almost cut his thumb off when he took it for a tool. Oh, the knife was made for darker things, it could not have been the rules. Let me tell you, camping once on the Boy Scout Jamboree, broke a half an inch off trying to stick it in a tree.
So Steve Earle, Guy Clark goes on to talk about his father, who, by the way, he was given that Randall blade, that knife, by Guy Clark's mother, his wife, when he went off to World War II. And he writes, my father died when I was 40. Couldn't find a way to cry. And also in this song, which is just mind-boggling, I don't think of Guy Clark as a Boy Scout, but, you know, his dad
I was a Boy Scout, too.
There you go.
So get rid of that one. So
that's right. Maybe like him, you went to a jamboree. He writes about that in this song.
I went to 3 jamborees. I developed discipline problems that I never quite made it to Eagle, but I was really into Scouts. I started as a Cub Scout
when
I was 8, and I was a Boy Scout until I was 12, I guess.
Yeah,
almost 13.
But talk a little bit more about, you know, the Guy Clark, who, as you write, he always seemed like he was going to reverse in age. He was younger all the time. But this man who, with that smoky voice, he becomes a certain character in our eyes. But he was a Boy Scout, and he had a father who had a knife that he'd throw. And, you know, just who was he? How did he grow up?
Well, it's 1 foot in West Texas, 1 foot in Southeast Texas and in the Gulf Coast. You know, his father practiced law in Houston part of the time and lived in Rockport. And Guy grew up in Rockport. He moved to Rockport when he was in high school. When he was younger, he ended up living, you know, with his grandmother. There's a whole West Texas school of songwriter, which Guy is sort of attached to because he does come from there. But I'm talking about Joe Ely and Butch Hancock and Terry Allen and all those guys. And, you know, I think Terry and he were very close, and I think West Texas was the common denominator, but that and art in and of itself. Because Guy painted as well, and he was pretty good.
It's late afternoon, a hot Texas day. Something strange going on. We're all in the way.
When you were doing these songs with your band, The Dukes, How much of this was memory for you?
This radio channel that I'm on, the satellite radio channel I'm on, has a cruise that we do every year.
Hmm.
And it's largely music. We play a lot of Guy Clark. The first place I actually played all this stuff in front of an audience was on that cruise. And I got two songs into it, and I said to the audience, oh, I just realized what the problem with this tour is going to be. It's going to be getting through this show without crying every night. It was incredibly emotional. Yeah. It was people in the audience were crying. And because, I mean, I think people in the world where I live, Guy Clark's a big deal. And he was a trip. He was not – he was one of the smartest people that I ever knew. He was one of the most stubborn people that I ever knew. We went through periods – when we did, we weren't really estranged, but we didn't hang out with each other a lot simply because I was just trying to not get myself around some things, and I knew they would be going on, so I kept myself away, and I communicated with him, and I would see him when we were out doing shows, but I didn't go over to his house for a long time. And then the last couple of years he was around, I made it a point to see him as much as I could. But it
well, let me just jump in to say you've been sober for two decades. So
it's 24 years.
All right, let's not take away a day. Go ahead.
They're all mine. So I know what I'm comfortable with and what I'm not comfortable with. And for a long time, I wasn't comfortable with putting myself right in the middle of all that. So I didn't. So there was a period that we didn't see each other for a while.
Right, but I hear you. And what I would have guessed is that this is there's a lot of emotion here, and for other people too. We're going to go out with the Guy Clark song, Old Friends, a lot of yours and his on the record. We'll listen for Rodney Crowell, Jerry Jeff Walker, Emmylou Harris, Sean Camp, Terry Allen, more.
Mickey Raphael plays harp on it because he was on all the Guy's early records. Mm-hmm. Berlin Thompson, that's most important because he was the Guy's guitar player and traveling companion for all the touring they did the last 25 years or so of his life.
Well, I can't imagine what it's like when you perform that one, but thank you so much for putting it together for all of us. That's Steve Earle, the new album, Guy, a tribute to Guy Clark. Steve, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Oh, friends, shine like diamonds. Oh, friends, you can always call. Oh, friends, Lord, you can't buy them. You know it's old friends after all.
It is a big day for sports fans across the country. The Sweet 16 gets underway tonight in men's college basketball. And spring is officially here, which means it is opening day for Major League Baseball. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hi, I didn't wear a jacket today because of the whole spring thing, and I think it was a mistake.
It's freezing.
You know, the weather don't care, but yeah.
Right. Well, let's start with the NCAA. 16 teams are left, including every top-ranked team. What are you watching for tonight?
Yes, every number 1, 2, and 3 seed. So I think that the number 1 seeds will probably still take hold. All of these 8 games in the Sweet 16 will take place today or tomorrow. Duke, which was the number 1 overall team, they survived a scare and an excellent an upset at the hands of Central Florida. So, I wouldn't say it's wide open, but I really do think that we fall into a trap if we think that the top seeds like Virginia and Duke and Gonzaga can't be defeated. I expect one or two of them to go down within the next 2 days.
Well, the lowest ranked team to make the Sweet 16 is number 12 seed Oregon. Why have there been so few upsets this year?
Right, and Oregon is a number 12 seed, but they play in a power conference, and they were a Final Four team a couple years ago, and their point guard was the point guard for a Final Four team a couple years ago, and I just think some years it shakes out like that. And also another reason is that the committee that does the seeding is getting better. So instead of being shocked, oh my God, look at this young upstart team that did so well, maybe they're naming that young upstart team from Central Washington Gonzaga, maybe they're correctly making them a number 1 seed, whereas a decade ago, no team like that could be named a number 1 seed.
Okay, let's talk about baseball. This is the time of year when every fan feels like their team has a chance to win the World Series. Who are your favorites?
Yeah, if you're a fan of the Orioles, you are wrong. Sorry. Tampa Bay Rays is similar. Actually, the Rays aren't that bad. The Red Sox, the returning champions, are fantastic. They have spent and will spend over $200 million to field a very good team. Let's just look at payroll. Here are the top paying teams in baseball. The Red Sox, the Cubs, the Yankees, the Dodgers. That's 1, 2, 3, and 4. They all have payrolls of about $200 million or a little above. And those could be the best teams. I also just named the four biggest favorites in Las Vegas to win the title. Weirdly, I would think the Red Sox would be the favorite. The Yankees are the favorite, maybe because people just like to bet on the Yankees. I don't agree with that, especially if you look at the fact that every team, there's no team that doesn't have a flaw here or there, but the Yankees' flaw, especially now, is starting pitching. And if you know anything about baseball, maybe it's a little less important than it used to be. It's still extremely important. And they have guys on the DL. They have CC Sabathia, who's in his final season, who's has some heart issues, and Luis Severino, who's starting the year on the DL, and I wouldn't trust them to be my favorite to win the World Series, is what I'm saying.
And two huge stars have new teams. Bryce Harper left Washington for the Phillies, and Manny Machado signed the Padres. They're making $630 million over the next 13 years between them.
Yeah, and Mike Trout on the Angels is making, or should be making, what they're making combined. And what those two movements do, I wouldn't say that either of their new teams are automatically contenders to, well, they're contenders. I wouldn't say they're favorites to win. But what they really did is decimated their old teams. And I did make fun of the Orioles a little bit. They have almost no chance to win this year. And the Nationals, which look like a dynasty, are reeling from the loss of Harper.
That is Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome.
It's been nearly a week since the special counsel Robert Mueller delivered his report on the Russia investigation to the Attorney General, William Barr. And all we know about the report is what's in Barr's four-page summary. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi commented on that today.
No, thank you, Mr. Attorney General. We do not need your interpretation. Show us the report, and we can draw our own conclusions. We don't need you interpreting for us. It was condescending, it was arrogant, and it wasn't the right thing to do.
The Democratic chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Gerald Nadler, says Barr told him the report from Mueller is hundreds of pages long, but less than 1,000. Democrats are trying to get the full report released, but Barr says he won't meet their deadline of next week. Washington Post national political reporter Robert Costa joins us now. Hi, Robert.
Good to be with you.
Now, you're in contact with White House officials and lawmakers. Is the White House worried about releasing the full report, even though the president says he's okay with it?
They are concerned inside of the West Wing, but they also believe that they could cite executive privilege to try to protect aspects of this document from public release. So they are in negotiations right now through the Department of Justice of figuring out what could be in this report, what might they want to cite as something that doesn't deserve to be viewed by the public. But the counter to all of that, the challenge for this White House, is that Congress has a huge role to play and they want to see this release made public.
Well, and in fact, Lindsey Graham, who's been an ally recently of President Trump, says that he doesn't think that they're going to use executive privilege to stop this report from getting out there.
And there's also an acknowledgement when you talk to officials close to President Trump that this document will likely be leaked anyway, or it will be released to Congress eventually. So the administration politically has a choice to make. How much do they really want to fight this, knowing that the public release is almost all but certain at some point?
Well, and as you said, Congress has a role to play here, and many Republicans have come out and said they want the full report released. In fact, a group of Republicans is now running an ad on Fox News quoting Republican lawmakers who once called for the full release of the report. Here's a little bit of that ad.
I think the report needs to be made public.
I would like for as much as possible of the Mueller report to be open.
And so we want to learn as much as we possibly can.
It's really important that this report be made public.
You hear Marco Rubio in there, Ted Cruz, Mitch McConnell. What are Republicans who have said that in the past thinking now?
Republicans know that President Trump is their ticket to 2020. If they have any chance of winning the presidency, he's still the incumbent. He's their person to help lift all boats across the party. At the same time, politically, they want to move on from the Mueller investigation. They want to talk about issues like health care, talk about the economy. And to be able to do that politically, you have to just move on. And to move on, many Republicans do believe the Mueller report, to some extent, should be released to the public. The question now for these Republicans is there something in this document, in this Mueller report, about possible obstruction of justice that's embarrassing to the president, embarrassing to Republicans, and they're a little nervous about that even as they call for it to be publicly released?
Well, just to remind people, according to William Barr, the attorney general, Mueller found no evidence of conspiracy with Russians, but on the issue of obstruction of justice, Mueller did not exonerate the president. However, Barr did. Do you think Democrats will subpoena the report? And if they do, will they get it?
Democrats have many options in front of them. They could issue a subpoena for the report. They can call up the attorney general to Capitol Hill to testify. Chairman Nadler of the House Judiciary Committee has already said he's spoken with the attorney general, talked about possibly having him come up to testify if necessary. You could also see Democrats try to bring up special counsel Robert Mueller, who has been so silent throughout this process.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think that they haven't come out right away and said that they're going to do that? They're being a little more careful about the idea of calling Robert Mueller to testify.
So far, Democrats, led by Speaker Pelosi, who is a savvy political operative, are trying to move forward and not be seen as overreaching. You think about Speaker Pelosi. She's been in the House for decades. She looks back at the Republican experience with President Obama, with President Clinton in the 90s when they moved to impeach President Clinton in the House. She knows that there's a political cost for any House majority that seems to be, quote, going after the president, and that people are sensitive to a House majority going after a president. If they want to be seen as moving in a judicious way and not moving toward impeachment, rushing toward that, not rushing to call up Barr or Mueller to testify, they want to see if they can get these documents on their own first.
Well, and they seem to be, the Democrats do, pretty happy that the conversation has shifted in part to back to health care, which was very good for them during the midterm elections. One more point, though, on the Mueller report and the Barr letter. Many conservatives are telling President Trump not to gloat about what happened last week. But here he is on Fox News last night.
Now that they see the Mueller report, where you look at their finding, I mean, the finding was very, very strong. No collusion, no obstruction, no Russia, no nothing. And it's great.
And the president has talked about investigating the people behind the Mueller investigation. They want the Democratic chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, to lose his chairmanship. What about that, this move on offense from the White House? And do you think they'll get some of the things they're asking for?
It's real, but Republicans tell me they need to be careful. When I speak to congressional leaders and congressional Republicans, they say, look, is there a lot of anger out there inside the White House among Republican-based voters about the Mueller investigation? Of course there is. But does that mean that Republicans should push to call for what they call a second special counsel, another investigation, this time to investigate the Justice Department and the process of investigating Secretary Clinton's emails and the process of investigating President Trump? Senator Graham of South Carolina has talked about that second special counsel idea, but so far Republicans are hesitant of really rallying behind it and look more for the Oversight Committee and the Republicans there, like Mark Meadows of North Carolina, a top ally of President Trump, to try to be an attack dog and go after the DOJ's leadership and look back and try to see what really happened from a Republican perspective.
Okay. So if the conversation does change, one of the things that it may change to is health care. And we were talking about it the last couple of days because the Department of Justice came out and said, now we're in favor of the courts overturning all of Obamacare. A lot of Republicans seem to be mystified by the president saying once again yesterday that he will try to get the entire Affordable Care Act repealed and he will replace it with what he called a great plan, although we have no details about what that is. Why is he trying to shift focus back to something that he failed at before?
It's jarring for many Republicans to see this sudden shift to health care so soon after the Mueller report has been completed. Many Republican sources of mine wish the president would just talk about the Attorney General's summary this week and not try to move on to a complicated issue like health care, but move on to health care he did, in part urged by Acting Chief of Staff in the White House, Mick Mulvaney, who's more of a conservative ideologue than others inside of the White House. And he believes that this is a moment to use political capital to revive the health care issue. But it comes with real political challenges because Democrats on the 2020 presidential campaign trail love to talk about health care, and they believe protecting the Affordable Care Act could be a real winner for them ahead of 2020.
And has there been some backroom work on a new plan? Because the Republicans were not able to come up with a plan last time to replace Obamacare with.
There are plans floating around there, but from people like Senator Alexander of Tennessee, but there's no coherent Republican plan. In fact, the House Minority Leader, a Republican from California, Kevin McCarthy, has warned the president there's not really a plan out there. This isn't the most politically strategic thing to be doing right now. So you could see this whole process stall if Republicans get uneasy about this revival.
And one more thing. What about pardons for some of the people that have been convicted, including Paul Manafort, in the entire Russia investigation? Do you think the president is likely to pardon them?
Rudy Giuliani, the president's lawyer, tells me the president isn't actively considering pardons, but that keywords actively. The president has it on his mind. Top Trump allies tell me it's unlikely that the president pardons Paul Manafort, his former campaign chairman, because that would be seen as a political mistake, because many Republicans don't want to be out there defending Paul Manafort, this former lobbyist. They do say a pardon for former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn could be more viable politically because he's seen as someone who's been a victim of the whole investigation, at least in the eyes of Republicans.
That is Washington Post national political reporter Robert Costa. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Forty years ago in Pennsylvania, this happened.
Good evening. The news tonight is not encouraging. To sum it up in a word, it is still confusing from Harrisburg. To bring you up to the minute, an unexpected release of more radiation today from the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant has led to a series of consequences.
That's WNEP anchor Gary Essex in 1979 with an update on what was then the worst accident in nuclear energy history. A pump stopped sending water to steam generators that cooled a reactor core at Three Mile Island. Unit 2's reactor went into partial meltdown. Radiation was released. An estimated 80,000 people fled southern Pennsylvania. Others were stocking up on potassium iodide pills to try to protect against potential radiation. It didn't help that just 12 days before, The China Syndrome, a film about a fictional meltdown, was released. Edmund Lyman is acting director of the Union of Concerned Scientists Nuclear Safety Project. Dr. Lyman, welcome.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
And can you just sum up how people reacted when this reactor went into partial meltdown, for those who, you know, weren't there in time?
Yes. Well, the public were not well informed of what was going on. Neither was the regulator, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Neither was the state government. There was very poor preparation for the kinds of communications that really need to happen quickly in the event of a nuclear accident. Right. So the information was just dribbling out, only caused greater anxiety and panic.
Well, and everyone got through it. It was not the disaster that it was feared it would be. And now we come to today. You know, support for nuclear energy, you know, has dropped at times, has been higher at times. Where is nuclear energy production now? Do you feel it's safer than it was 40 years ago?
Nuclear energy is certainly safer than 40 years ago. But the question is it safe enough? And in our view, no. Mm. Part of the reason is the tremendous economic pressure that the nuclear industry is in today because of the low prices of natural gas that are leading to calls for cutting regulations that protect safety and security.
Yeah. And in fact, no brand new facilities have been built since Three Mile Island. There's one being built in Georgia, but it's way behind schedule and is needing federal loans to be pumped in. It's way over budget. Right now, nuclear power provides about 20% of the country's electricity, but a third of the plants are either unprofitable or scheduled to close. We mentioned Three Mile Island. The owners say it's just too much competition from natural gas. They want the state to step in. Some states are stepping in. What do you say to even, you know, the progressives and the liberals, people like Rachel Pritzker and the investor Amy Dominy, who have changed their mind on nuclear energy because of climate change. They say that it is necessary because it is zero emissions.
Well, to be clear, my organization, the Union of Concerned Scientists, has always been steadfastly neutral on this broader question of yes or no nuclear power. Climate change is, of course, a great concern. There are many different tools that could be used to mitigate climate change. Nuclear energy is one of them, but nuclear energy also has significant liabilities that make it different from renewable energy, low-carbon sources, and that is the potential for a severe accident or a terrorist attack. So those are serious issues, and they have to be addressed if nuclear power is to be a significant part of the energy mix in the future.
Another question that people have is waste. We're reading articles of people who still live in the shadows. And by the way, when you live near a plant like this, you're usually in the shadow. They are these hulking, giant facilities. And a woman who says, you know, I can't afford to move away, but even if they close it, the waste is still stored there. So explain why that's an issue.
That's absolutely true. Spent nuclear fuel is a very highly radioactive material that is dangerous for hundreds of thousands of years and needs to be isolated from the environment. But because of the inability to find a safe geologic repository, all the plants in the United States have to store all their nuclear waste at the site. Mm-hmm. The current configuration for storing much of that waste is in swimming pool-like structures, which are packed so tightly with this hot material that they have to be actively cooled using pumps and electricity. And so there is a danger if those pools lose their cooling rapidly that they could catch fire and release more radiation than we actually saw after the Fukushima events.
Mm. Look, even the UN in its fall climate change report called for an increase in nuclear power production by a factor of 5. A new Gallup poll just this week shows Americans are evenly split on the use of nuclear power, you know, which means half are in favor. What, in your mind, given that, as we said, you know, many progressives who are against nuclear power are saying, given climate change, we have to take the risks. What's the number one thing you'd want to see happen in order to go forward with nuclear power? Let's say states and the federal government step in and subsidize some of these plants.
Well, I would want to see, again, the primary focus on ensuring safety and security. There really is no compromise here. If states are going to subsidize nuclear power, they have to take all the measures necessary to make sure that they are safe and secure.
Yeah, top security. Dr. Enwin Lyman, Director of the Union of Concerned Scientists Nuclear Safety Project, on this, the 40th anniversary of Three Mile Island. And you only have to say those three words to many Americans. Dr. Lyman, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.